Matt, awesome to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us here on Emerging Excellence. And where I'd love to start is actually just for people to understand a bit more about your background and kind of your expertise.
Sure. Now, thanks for having invited me on, Michael, and hopefully I'll be able to provide an insight for your listeners as well. Yeah, so just to give a short background and bio of my history. So a fledgling playing career within football up until the age of around about 18 years old. And then the decision starts to happen when you go through like education programs and college and universities. What do I want to do next? And I started, ironically, doing some coaching within my local authority, after school coaching, engagement coaching, and just started to gain a good interest and knowledge of working with young people on within football coaching. That progressed over time. And well, I left college, I went to the University of Birmingham to do a sports management degree, which gave me a broad range of skills and insights and content within that program as to how to manage organizations and how to manage within sporting framework as well. That led, at the end of my degree, that led me to starting my own sports coaching company, which worked across local authorities and regions and really focused on community engagement programs through football and alternative sports as well, whereby we operated a football and sports coaching development program for the local authority, working within schools, within education provision, within children and young people at risk, and also working within community engagement programs as well. And within, as that business started to develop and grow, we started to employ more people and the program started to develop. On the side of that, then we started to merge as part of the organization into a charity, a registered charity, which extended the program and the reach of what that program did. Alongside the business operation side of things is I started working with an academy within elite youth development at Birmingham City, where I worked for about 4 years part-time coaching with young players between the age of 9 and 14 predominantly. And then as that started to progress, my interest within elite sports development and talent development environments grew, and the opportunity arose to go to West Bromwich Albion full-time. And that was in around about 2012. Where I held a joint role as football operations manager and youth development phase coach. So it gave me an opportunity to work with a lot of the operational side of how a business and an organization within a talent development environment worked, and also gave me opportunity to work on the pitch with young players each and every day, which gave me two strings to my bow, if you like, as to how an elite sporting environment worked at youth level. And I could really immerse myself within that over around about a 10-year period. As you start to develop through those areas, my skills and within coaching and went through the FA education pathway to up to UEFA A license and advanced youth awards, and then went on to through West Bromwich Albion, went on to a Premier League elite football coaching course, which really provided a kind of a holistic understanding as to, not necessarily in terms of coaching practice, but really understand as to how I operate in terms of my own self-awareness, self-reflection, and how to manage manage myself and how to manage people. That coupled with the business side of things really opened my kind of understanding and self-awareness as to how to operate within this environment. After about 10 years at West Brom, I moved to Swansea City to head a youth phase here. Where I'm currently at the moment. My role here is to manage the multidisciplinary team of staff. So that's from coaches to sports scientists and performance staff to education staff to analysis staff and all the support network and the medical team around the coaching of the player and managing the development of the player as they move throughout the youth development phase, which within Swansea and within the English framework is from ages 13 to 16. With a real focus on supporting the player's pathway and transition through the stages into senior environments post 16.
And as I understand it, just if we talk the business case around youth academies, it's more than just it's a genuine, they're developing talent in that space. It is for commercial purposes, Matt, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yeah, you would be right. I think as every, I'm sure people will know, is football in England is big business, and it's big business because it generates an awful lot of money at the top end of the game, with the Premier League especially, and with a huge pyramid all the way down of 92 football clubs all striving to get up the ladder as high as they possibly can. The talent development environment and the academy system is very much seen as a potential production line for businesses to produce their own talents and their own assets at a fraction of the cost as to what it might cost to go and purchase, for example, a ready-made individual, a ready-made player for their first team. And as we know, that the reach of Premier League first teams now isn't just domestically, it's internationally, it's globally. So the kind of requirements of academies to produce world-class talents and world-class players to meet the demands of what a first team needs at the highest level of the game. There's no doubt about it that chairmen, CEOs of football clubs will look on a balance sheet and say, what can we invest within our talent development environment? How much does it cost for a cycle from an under nine when a player enters the academy youth system to a potential debut at, say, 20? Over that period of time, how much would it cost us in terms of resources compared to going and buying a ready-made world-class international footballer from elsewhere? And clubs and CEOs will see, and rightly so, that there is value in investing within their own talent and within their own, certainly within their own local community, because it has a really strong effect on community and fan base if players from their local area that supporters can relate to. If they get into their first team, then the commercial value of that particular player that might be in their first team is significant, and clubs will see and have seen value in that. Not all clubs, but a lot of clubs will see value in that. The difficulty is, certainly within the Premier League, is that takes a little bit of time. And unfortunately, in football, that clubs, chairmen, managers, coaches, it's in wanting instant success, but not necessarily prepared to wait for that, which, as we know, with the talent development environments, that it does take time. So it's a little bit of a double-edged sword, but clubs and CEOs will see and do see value in investing significantly into their youth development systems.
Yeah, very good. And I think, look, it's a fascinating world, and I think one which would be quite foreign for perhaps a lot of people listening to this. But what I think is interesting about what you've been doing is that, and you've just published a paper, or forgive me, maybe not just Matt, but there's a published, I came across you a couple of weeks ago through a great show called the Dan Abrams Sports Psych Show, which I highly, it's become one of my favorite podcasts, actually. I'm a huge Dan Abrams fan. The thing which struck me was that you've done some analysis work at over 40 different sporting academies across the UK. And I'm less interested in terms of, like, maybe how you get someone to kick a ball a little bit better than someone else, but I'm very interested to understand what were your kind of general findings when you were starting to look at what it takes to develop talent, because a lot of companies have challenges with talent development in a corporate context, because when it comes to it, maybe there are very few people really can stand the pressures of corporate life, can understand and think around and navigate multi-billion dollar businesses and handle the pressure of all that. So maybe I'd love to start with how do soccer teams think about what it takes to perform in the first team, as an example? Because there's the skill, there's the capability, the ability to run fast, all of those kind of physical skills. But then there's all, how do you handle 80,000 people screaming at you? And how do you handle all of that? So I'd be very interested to understand, how do you evaluate the whole picture and what's required well beyond just physical capability?
Yeah, sure. I think the very simple answer to your question is nobody knows. And nobody has the magic formula, if you like. And there are clubs and academies investing heavily in research and development and design and staff and resources and equipment and a multitude of different things to try and find out ultimately and to find out what and predict what is that golden ticket, if you like, what's that little edge and a competitive advantage that we can gain over our competitors to produce the next multi-million pound asset. And I think what we find is that there's a heavy investment in resources and equipment and infrastructure. And you often find that the wealthier academies and the wealthier businesses will focus upon on those areas, which is fine and is great, but that not doesn't necessarily produce talent and an asset when you're working with people. And the research, which I'll touch on in a moment, has often found that academies that really can focus upon what really matters and that can focus on those discriminating factors and cohesively work together and share have real clarity in what they're doing can bear fruit and can pay dividends in producing players. Now, also another thing just to try and explain as well to your listeners is the English league system. You've got the very wealthy and a huge corporate brands at the top, so that the top six, and then that filters all the way down to national league and semi-professional and so on. And so that the actual system is huge. And what the Premier League did in terms of the governing body of the sport in 2011, after a significant period of perceived underachievement within youth development, set up a structured framework to categorize academies to produce more what they call homegrown players to get more English footballers into clubs' first teams. Now, what that looks like is going to be slightly different at the big, huge Manchester United's, Chelsea's, Arsenal's, etc., than what it might look like in the second tier or the third tier. Now, the key findings of the research that I've done so far is what matters at the top end probably matters a little bit further down, and the productivity of academies further down can be as important and as valuable and provide as much asset as the ones at the top by producing players and assets within their framework of where they operate, if you like, because the net is cast very wide. And obviously, as you'll be aware, is at the very top, there might be one space or one player, but that might be a multi-million pound player. Whereas the further you come down the pyramid and down the English system, teams can produce a multitude because there's more opportunity ultimately. And I wouldn't say the pathway is easier, but the criteria is probably less as you go further down. Now, what the Premier League did at the start of what was called the Elite Player Performance Plan in 2011 was categorize academies based on a variety of criteria. And that was every football club that wanted to operate a talent development environment. So the categories were from 1 to 4, with 1 being perceived the highest and then generating the most Premier League funding. So, for example, the Chelseas and the Arsenals and Manchester Uniteds with the big resources and the big talent development environments often were categorized as number 1. And then there's category 2 academies, which down into the mid reaches of the Football League. And there was scope for clubs to move within categories over time. So what there was, there became an independent audit process, very similar to what we have certainly in England in terms of Ofsted, in terms of school criteria within education. Is clubs would be measured on those areas and remeasured over time. And clubs would then be categorized based on their level of coaching facilities, resources, programs, coaching programs, medical programs, education provision. And then that then produced a standardization in the eyes of the Premier League to ensure or attempt to ensure that the best talent, the best assets were being filtered to the top end of the game, then to the top businesses, if you like, and within the being in the top businesses, then surely they would be getting the best coaching, the best program, the best facilities, the best resources, with a view that would produce the best talent. And you have to say that after a 10-year review that the Premier League just published in last year or so, is it has worked. The guidelines and the criteria on homegrown is a little bit grey, if I'm honest, but they've
certainly... What do you mean by that?
So if you were to class homegrown player is that, and the benchmark has shifted in terms of homegrown players, people will probably say homegrown player would be a person that enters the system at, say, 9 or 10 years old, comes through the system, and he's a local person, he's a local boy, he's a local person within the framework, within the community, and he goes on to play in the first team. Whereas the scope would to bring in international players at, say, age 16, if, let's say, a club brought in a player from Europe at 16 and was involved within the academy for a 2-year scholarship at 16, 17, 18, he would be classed as a homegrown player. So it's a little bit political, if I'm honest, but notwithstanding, there's no doubt that the success of the England national teams at junior age groups at 15, 16, 17, 18, 20, winning World Cups, winning European Championships,
right,
is probably a byproduct of the PPP system. And there's no doubt that the system itself has upskilled everybody within the organisation, the business, made people accountable, made staff accountable for their work and their actions, and probably, and without a shadow of a doubt, increase the quality of provision that our young players are provided with. And there's no doubt that's been a product of producing better talent at the end of the 10-year period.
I think what's interesting about the sport clubs is that they themselves have moved almost like vertically integrated to become talent development machines themselves. So if you think about the corporate world, it's quite different. If you take a building firm, they just do building, largely speaking, right? And not many of them really think to build out their talent programs. And if they do, it's usually fairly lightweight. But what we're seeing in the Premier League, isn't it, is a whole different kettle of fish, right? They go, right, we're the experts at playing this sport, but we're also going to become the experts in developing the people to become the future as well. And I feel like that's a really interesting shift in model and even mindset, perhaps, from a corporate context, is that businesses, and maybe this will be the way to go, because down here, and forgive me, I'm not too sure about the UK, but in Australia, we're seeing decline in people going to university for probably the first time in maybe decades. And I wonder whether that's an opportunity, because in many regards, university has become a little bit detached, if not a lot detached, from actual corporate outcomes. And I think that's an interesting piece. Your work, Matt, though, across those 40 different clubs, as I understand what you were saying, you've got the 1, 2, 3, 4 rating. You've got the top clubs achieving level one because they're perceived to be the best because they've got the funding, the coaching staff, the facilities and the pitches, etc. Level 2, 3, and 4 they designed a system to support the one, or were 2, 3, and 4 really about trying to improve 2, 3, and 4 levels as well, to try and get them to be a higher level? Was that the intent?
Yeah, I think, and levels 2, 3, and 4 is have, for want of a better word, a kind of watered down criteria. So they will have the same criteria in terms of specific safeguarding, welfare, player care, being the safe to operate, being the kind of non-negotiables. They're the black and white. So they are not watered down. So what, and rightly so, the importance of child and staff welfare is criteria, black and white. Now, where the different gradings then come in is, for example, it might be access to a full-time coaching model being an obvious example. So a category one will be able to recruit nationally from the age of 12, which then opens up the lower grading teams to losing players. And clubs will then be able to operate what's called a full-time coaching model. So essentially, the club could provide education in-house or a linked education provider, could provide a full-time coaching program during the daytime as well. And essentially from the age of 12 upwards, that young boy could well be essentially classed as a full-time footballer from the age of 12. Now, as that then filters down to category two and category three, that full-time model isn't in place. National recruitment doesn't happen until post-16. The clubs at two, three, and four are operating within the same environment as the category ones, with kind of one hand tied behind the back because they don't have access to the provision that they maybe want or would like to have. But then also, they could quite easily have their biggest assets cherry-picked by the big corporate organisations, the big brands, who can provide a wealth of resource, a wealth of staffing structure, a wealth of coaching program and education program and all that kind of holistic development around it. And because ultimately they have the most finance. So it does streamline talent to an extent. However, it does potentially hamper the operationalization of a coaching program a little bit further down the categories. So it's probably those category of clubs that are operating with one hand behind their back a little bit, with always one eye over the shoulder that their best talent can be cherry-picked at any time. And unfortunately, that the compensation system that's in place where players can move between, say, category two to category one isn't really sufficient for the amount of resource and development time that club or that organisation has put into that player. For example, there's around about £9,000 to £10,000 per year per registration. So 9,000 at nine, at 10, etc. It gets a little bit more when the players get older and you can start to offer scholarships at the age of 14 plus. So that then becomes an asset on the player's head. So then what you start to find is clubs will look to protect their assets, even if they're not quite sure about whether that young player at 14 will be an asset in the future, they will essentially contract them up to stop players moving onwards, and it puts a financial cost on the head if a club wants to take them. So it's managing your assets, and it's definitely protecting your assets, which you can fully understand.
Yeah, 100%. Let's dive into it more in terms of your research now, in terms of what were the... You said there was no specific kind of like secret source. In fact, people are still pursuing or trying to find the secret source, as it were. But what were, when it comes to talent development, what were some of the key things that you found across the board, or maybe some of the surprises in there too, that academies believe to be important in terms of the development of their players?
Yeah, sure. So the three research aims that we looked at were, as you just mentioned there, is to understand what factors academies believe to be important in the development of their players, to explore what academies are tracking and how they're measuring the performance of their players and their assets, and then to analyze to what extent those factors are then integrated into what we call the player curricula. Now, just to define what player curricula means is, see, the experience that we want the player to have. So people will be used to school curricula, for example, an education curricula. So we looked at how those measuring and tracking influences were put into developing curricula. And subsequent research has gone on to explore that a little bit further. So the results were as expected to an extent, but very broad in terms of how they're operationalized on a day-to-day basis within academies. So how we define factors was through what's called the FA four corner model. So the Football Association four corner model, which places technical and tactical skills in one box, places psychological skills in another box, physical skills in another box, and then social skills in another box. And they're they're looked at very much in silo, very much individualized. And a lot of, if not all clubs, build their curricula and their assessment criteria around those four areas. So we delved into a little bit as to actually what do highly experienced talent developers within English academies, what's their experience telling them, and what have they seen in terms of how they've developed policy and the players that they've worked with over a period of time, so over a 10-year period plus, is what do they think are the most important factors within that has helped their academy or the academies that they've worked in, their experiences, produce players. Now, what we found was that the physical factors were slightly overdone. And I'll come back to a little bit around the operationalization of that in a moment. And that technical, tactical, and in particular, psychological characteristics were the most important factors in players eventually becoming professional footballers within their experience. Now, when I go back to talk about the EPPP, is the EPPP had us put a system in place that mandated that we take physical fitness testing data from players 3 times a year throughout their journey, with a view of putting it all into a national database, comparing it chronologically and biologically, and tracking the progression of players over time, which is fine. But the research would suggest that maybe the physical characteristics and developing physical skills isn't the most important factor when it comes to developing players, and certainly isn't as important as developing psychological characteristics and certainly technical and tactical skills.
Sorry, just to jump in there, Matt. So you're saying we've got a database of all these players at academy level for the last 10 years, and we've tracked their physical performance 3 times a year for 10 years, right?
Yes. Yes.
Wow. Okay. So even though we can't look at the other things, okay, so you're saying that's skewed a little bit in terms of everyone then goes, okay, let's just try and enhance physical. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the research would suggest it creates an illusion of objectivity. So it's easy to measure. It takes a stopwatch, some simple equipment, and everybody likes a number and everybody likes a statistic. So surely if it's easy to measure, then it's important.
Yeah.
But the other characteristics, so developing psychological characteristics, for example, developing technical and tactical skills, there are no mandated criteria from the Premier League to say, this is how we would like you to measure. This is our requirement to measure. And this is how we track the longitudinal development of our players. Now, that would also then bring into the realms of how do you measure tactically? How do you measure technically? How do you measure psychologically? And often that's actually quite difficult. So clubs and academies throughout the pyramid have their own criteria and their own means in which to measure and track those skills. Everyone will have their own framework, and often it will be measured subjectively. Now, if we had a conversation about and we watched a video of somebody taking a penalty, for example, we might have completely different perceptions as to actually what was the technique like, what was the ball strike like, what was the decision like. And then you can throw into the realms of actually when you mentioned about playing in front of 80,000 people, what kind of pressurized environment is that player under to take that penalty? Mm. And then with all those things into the mix, then how do we actually measure that? And then ultimately, how do we coach it? How do we put it into a player curriculum? So those seem to be, the research would suggest that those seem to be the most discriminating factors and the most important things, especially when it comes to players transitioning from youth to senior football and earning a professional contract. But there seems to be less requirement and there seems to be less importance placed on actually how are we tracking the development of our players, our assets. If we perceive these to be the most important things, why are we not placing more importance on tracking the development of these players? Because ultimately, if that's the important thing, that could be something to focus upon with a little bit more weighting, which might mean that we might produce more players because we've got a curricula and a process in place and a model and framework in place to work on the most important things. And then at the end of the next cycle, we might actually produce, if we invest more resources and time and effort into developing those factors, that might produce more players at the end of it. So
finish your sentence.
No, I was just going to say, so there is very much a subjectivity, objectivity to it. We would certainly recommend building systems and frameworks in place to work on the most important factors based on the research and certainly the experience of myself and my co-authors on the paper.
So the data, what you're saying would suggest that certain players who, let's say, and I'm going to try and make it as simple as possible, is that if their physical, if I'm using the right language, their physical capabilities were tested for over a 10-year period, and even though their performance appeared to be improving, what you're saying is that improvement, quote unquote, didn't necessarily correlate to them being picked up or becoming professional soccer players, which would suggest that actually it was some other improvement that was had stronger correlation with actual first team outcomes. Is that right?
Yeah. So we've begun to look at some information tracking around those areas, which we're looking into in our next paper, which will hopefully provide a bit more of a detailed insight into some of those things that you've just suggested. And what certainly is the case is that academy systems and resource and processes potentially is being invested into an area that isn't of as much importance in terms of developing players. Now, we, in terms of the tracking and measuring that you mentioned there, is over time, as a player gets older, surely they're going to get quicker, they're going to get faster, they're going to get stronger, and they're going to jump higher, run quicker, turn quicker, etc. Surely their scores are going to get better. Now, to throw then more consideration and more interference into that area is when a young player develops, they're all developing physically in terms of their maturation and growth at different times. So you have early maturers and early physical developers. You'll have mid-range ones, later ones. Yeah. But then we're tracking their physical characteristics, but then we're comparing them against each other, which even as I mentioned earlier, certainly chronologically is common practice. So measuring a 14-year-old against a 14-year-old, completely different maturation levels to assess physical fitness for an invasion sport, which requires a lot of other characteristics. But also what we're doing is we're, even when measuring and comparing biologically, there's a 14-year-old late maturer and there's a 14-year-old late maturer, if that makes sense. Is it's very, very hard to compare one to another because there's so many different factors within their development. For example, a 14-year-old might be able to sprint over 30 meters very quickly, for example. Great, no problem. But if his decision-making isn't as fast as the other person, then he might have got out the blocks quick enough, or he might not have recognized, he hasn't got his awareness and perception of maybe his attacker against him, for example, in a 1v1 scenario. He might not have positioned his body in the right manner. He might have not recognized that the attacker was moving in a certain space and he hasn't seen him, for example, which means he's late moving. So there's so many contributory integrated factors within that. Is then we start to look at, actually, our physical characteristics, do they just become maintenance? Is being fast enough good enough?
Yeah.
Which we're starting to delve into a little bit more with future research. Whereas actually now, if we're saying that technical, tactical, and certainly psychological characteristics are what we would potentially call performance characteristics, is then are we focusing on that in terms of what we're measuring? Are we focusing on that in terms of what we're doing day to day with the player to make sure that his awareness, his position, his body position, et cetera, as I just mentioned as an example, are we really focusing upon that as what we're going to work on collectively and cohesively as a coaching team around him? And that would be the key finding from this paper, is directing our attention towards what are the potential performance factors and the most important factors in developing players.
Are there any interesting anomalies that you came across in terms of like clubs who are actually like they really double down on like a psychological factor or technical? Was better linked to these outcomes?
Yeah, so a common theme was developing technical skills at the younger age groups. So what we call here is the foundation phase. So commonly under nines age to under 12s age. So there was a common theme of structured, standardized, systematic processes within the younger age groups, with a view that if we work on everything and we spend a certain amount of time on everything, then that we have ticked all boxes, covered all bases to ensure that the player, as they move into like the mid-age groups, the under 13s and upwards, that we can say, yeah, we have exposed and we have supported the player with working on 1v1 defending, receiving, passing, shooting, etc. That's definitely a common theme. And then as we started to move through the mid-range ages, so from 13 upwards, common practice within academies now through the direction of the Premier League is to develop what's called an individual development plan or individual learning plan. So every player, and sometimes within academies with more resource, will do it a little bit younger, like I said, into the foundation phase, but developing an individual learning plan or individual development plan that's tailored for that player to work on what the club and what the academy think is what's needed to upskill the player to make them better at what they're good at and to make them better at what they're not very good at, for example. So working, increasing, making strengths better and improving weaknesses or removing barriers, whichever terminology you want to use. We would then say is within that model is if we identify, we mentioned with regards to the physical characteristics, is if we're focusing on trying to make a player faster, for example, and we're focusing attention on that, that might not be a well-guided use of resource in comparison to developing psychological characteristics a little bit younger to provide a wide variety of coping skills, motivation tactics, self-imagery, self-reflection, etc., that can underpin development of those other key factors. So as the player then goes through the challenges of a talent development environment, is do they have the important skills that can help potentially them in the future? Do they have the skills then to underpin improving what they need to improve? So a simple example would be if a player wants to improve his passing, if he's not motivated to improve his passing, he's not going to improve his passing. That would probably be a simplistic example that are we working on developing his motivation to improve his ability to go and self-practice to get more contact time and improve his passing skills, for example.
Interesting. Yeah, it's like we had the pleasure of having Dr. Paul Mansell from Staffordshire Uni come on and talk about his kind of stress mindset. And it's interesting, a lot of their work is about, it's the mindset or it's the thinking about something else which guides us. So you're thinking about stress, your perspectives on stress, which are far more important. And I keep thinking in this conversation, I think it's the Arsenal striker, Saka, right? In terms of he was in the, I think it was it the semi, was it the World Cup final or something like that? It was penalties. And it was like this 18-year-old guy, lad, and he missed the penalty. And then he got absolutely slaughtered by the British or the English football fans. And it's like horrific to see. But it's amazing to see now is how good he's really become. So I really feel like there must have been some investment to that guy, hopefully very early, to develop the skills and the psychological skills to handle the pressure, because there's kicking the ball, there's all that stuff. But that whole picture around what it really takes to perform, but maybe that's not even the scope of your research, Matt, right? Because you're saying just getting into a first team is like quote unquote success. Whereas what we're talking about in that, or sorry, what I'm talking about in that context is performance at the highest possible level of the game. So that's quite different from what you're talking about. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. It is a little bit. I'll try and provide my own experiences on that. And there's the knowing a little bit about the framework at that club a little bit, and also certainly within the England national teams, is pressure training is a definite one that I know that that Saka would have gone through. Always difficult to recreate that kind of pressure, and it's one that I think most recently we've seen Mikel Arteta playing "You'll Never Walk Alone" music on within the office to try and prepare them. And there's lots of different things that you see and hear around. And that kind of developing pressure, like pressure training and being able to find strategies to cope within those environments is critical. And the example that you've just used there is absolutely correct. So going how that would link potentially to our research is I'm sure that the Arsenal would have been developing those characteristics from a younger age on a day-to-day basis with the coaching team, not just maybe the performance psychologist, but the coach, the education team, the analysis team, the physio, the academy manager, the head of coaching, and then outside of the immediate organization is in terms of stakeholders, agents, for example, parents, is I'm sure that they would have been all having the same model and the same shared mental model of actually, what is he working on? How are we going to help him deal with pressure and stress? And we're all working together with the same terminology, with the same reference, with the same coaching to ensure that they're all on the same page to make sure that he's getting a coherent message in the club, away from the club, in the car, at home, which I'm sure would have happened within their system. And that's potentially the outcome of the player then has the tools to cope with those future demands and future challenges. Now, when it just quickly is going back to where it's about developing curricula, I would also say that he would have had been a highly successful, well, he was certainly a highly successful youth player throughout the Arsenal system, but they would have produced challenges and would have put bumps in the road, if you like, to help challenge him technically, tactically, psychologically, and I'm sure physically as well, is to provide him with enough challenge with appropriate support to give him a wide toolbox of skills when he gets into that moment that he can draw upon and say, that's how I deal with it. And not only how do I deal with it psychologically, is now I'm taking penalties with a better technique, or for example, and my tactics of which corner am I going to go to, what's the goalkeeper doing, what's the position, what's the weight, and et cetera, et cetera. So all of that is integrated and will have been focused upon younger. But the key thing is developing that within the player, his curricula, as I'm sure, providing the challenge, providing the support, focusing upon what's important, because clearly 15 years later, whatever it might be, that's quite an important factor.
Yeah, it's quite. I listened to a McTominay interview on, I think he was on High Performance. I'm not sure if you've seen or heard that one. But he was, McTominay, just for those who don't know, is a young player at Manchester United. He's come through their academy. I think he's been there like 15 years or something like that. It's like incredible. Yeah. He's only like 24, 25, or maybe 26, something like that. And he shared a story about the youth team were playing the first team. And he said the referee seemed to be biased towards the first team. And he really got frustrated by this biased referee, even though it was only quote unquote friendly. And yeah, he started to give the first team players a bit of jip. And long story short, Mourinho, who was the coach at Man U at the time, called McTominay up. And I think his words were something like, ripped him a new one or something like that. Really dressed him down. But actually, and he was like, oh my God, I'm never going to play for Manchester United ever again. It was awful. But actually, it probably highlighted more than Mourinho apparently loved it. Loved that kind of like that fire in his belly. And I think maybe 6 weeks later, he actually got the call up to the first team. And so, I think it's all, I think what's amazing about elite sport is they think about challenge. They really do understand that it's not, like you say, the bumps in the road, which I think our schooling system almost does the opposite now, Matt. I'd be interested to hear your take on it, or maybe your reflections on how different are the world or the talent, quote unquote, development in the non-elite world is so different to the elite. Like the elite sport encourages bumps, encourages hardship, encourages not making it easy, versus school is all about, oh, you did great. You came 10th. Well done. That's really amazing. Here's a medal, that kind of concept. So just from that regard, what are some of the key differences you notice between elite versus, let's say, non-elite?
Yeah, I think you would be fair in your assessment. I think society has changed and mentalities have changed. I think parents are certainly adverse to challenge. And I think certainly recreational level to an extent. And that smooth pathway doesn't exist necessarily. And you would argue that potentially players that don't have those challenges and bumps in the road. And my two co-authors have done some quite a lot of work and a lot of research and on providing those challenges and bumps as well. And their research would suggest that players have to discriminate between players that make it and players that don't, is having been experienced and being able to cope with those challenges and those bumps. Right. And a way to kind of explain it within a football sense, if you like, within youth development, is you've got Wi-Fi bandwidth and you've got a certain amount of bandwidth that you've got available. Now, within that bandwidth then is, if you only use the bottom half, the bottom 10%, you're only going to use the bottom 10%. So you're going to come to the end of your contract in 10 years' time and you'll have never used 90%. Now, within that bandwidth then is you provide some spikes and challenges within that program. So you're now down to use 50%, 60%, then down to 20% because I couldn't use 50% because it was too hard. Now, all of a sudden, I'm trying to download something and I've only got 20%. So now I've got to jump up and overcome the next challenge. Research would suggest that players that have that bump and have those bumps and the pathway goes a little bit like that, those are the players that then have the coping skills across the technical, tactical, psychological to cope with the demands at whatever they're going to encounter, like the Saka penalty you mentioned a little bit later on. Now, the danger within that is when we provide challenges outside of that bandwidth. So if I've got 4G and I try and download a movie that's 5G, for example, where the technology might be, I'm not sure, then that's outside of my bandwidth, which may be detrimental to the player's development, or it might not. Now, what kind of support do we then give to bring it back inside the bandwidth? Now, an example within my context for that is, the perception is that if a player's doing well, let's move him into the next age group. Now, often those decisions are based on physical maturation or perceived physical capability. And I differentiate those between maturation being maturated and physical proficiency and capability being, in terms of physical skills, being different things. Now, if a club or an academy makes that decision to, let's say, right, we're going to go and challenge that player because it's too easy for him in that group, let's move him into the next age group. But then actually, are we considering, is that player technically, tactically, and certainly psychologically and socially, is he ready for that next big challenge, or is it outside of his bandwidth? Now, I'll be big and strong, and I'm the same as the next age group up, but my social, psychological, psychosocial skills aren't yet developed enough for that next level, or my technical skills will mean that I find it really hard to cope with the demands of that next level. And then we start to perceive, and coaches do, well, we play him in the next age group up because physically he's dominant. But if we're saying, and the research here, as I mentioned, would say, if physical characteristics and physical skills aren't as important, but we're judging on maturation to potentially to provide those bumps in the road, has the player, or are we missing something where the player might not be technically, tactically, and certainly psychologically have the toolbox and the skills able to cope with that next challenge, which then may be detrimental to their long-term development, certainly.
The tricky thing with all of that is measurement, right? Isn't it? Isn't it? Because it sounds like, yeah, okay, great. We really need to be able to understand the 15-year-old Saka, 14-year-old Saka. Do we level him up now into the next level? The question is, how do you accurately gauge the quote-unquote bandwidth that they've got, right?
Sure. And I think our future research has delved into that in a little bit of detail. The key thing in terms of what you mentioned there would be is the coaches and the staff that are working with that player, it's really important that they are crystal clear with what are the most important things and then how are they then measuring and what do those measurements mean. So my perception of Saka dribbling at 14, a certain thing, whereas my counterpart coach might have a different perception. So now our ratings become a little bit grey and a little bit merged. Now, if I'm going to say the under-14s coach and I perceive him to be, for argument's sake, a 5 out of 5,
yep.
But then the under-15s coach thinks he's a 2 out of 5. Mm. Now, his perceptions of Saka's skills, a 15-year-old skills, or the level of maybe past players that have come through the system, or the requirements of the game at the top end, so it's a top-down approach, could all be slightly different. So now all of a sudden there's potentially mixed feedback and mixed messages.
Yeah.
And certainly, as you mentioned, there is a misalignment in measuring between me and the next coach. So now all of a sudden you start to see his measurement going like that, and then he drops off like that. Actually, should it have been there in the first place, or is it there or is it not? Now, if we then start to, like, within businesses and within organizations in your context, and it's no different within academy talent development environments, if we would propose that by building a shared mental model framework that is inclusive of those areas that I just mentioned, that will potentially bring a clarity of meaning as to what those things are. So that would then enhance the validity and potentially in the future the predictability of what that means for that player at that time. And then, as you mentioned there, ultimately is the next generation of player or the next coach that comes into that system has a similar or same clear understanding as to actually what is that element, what does it look like, and what are the stages of that element as well. And is everybody within the organization clear?
Can you talk to us about that, Matt, briefly? Because, again, it sounds simple, but actually I feel like the practical application or development of a shared mental model would be just a total nightmare. I'm also mindful of time. We've gone, so you let me know whether we've got the time to go into deep into this or not. But maybe if you could help me understand just briefly, how do you go about building a shared mental model where you can help remove some of the disparity between that under 14 coach and under 15 coach, as an example?
Yeah, sure. So firstly, just to define what I mean by that. So a shared mental model to facilitate the player's pathway through their system. And now, in essence, supporting the coaching team's ability to rationalize and project the needs of their players over time. So you mentioned about the measuring system. So measuring them over time to develop a genuine curriculum that is operationally coherent. So it runs day to day with all the relevant stakeholders, and it's coherent with how it's operationalized. Now, a simple example might well be is, I mentioned about Saka's dribbling, or it might be a business element that you want to touch upon. Now, how does an organization ensure that everybody within that organization knows what that means, know what it looks like, and operate on the same level? Now, that might be through the means of discussion-based workshops, whereby there is practical examples, discussion to be held within the organization, and a collective agreement is made as to what that might be based on our experiences. Now, that might not necessarily be the CEO that says this is how it is, because who's to say that the CEO knows exactly what it is in terms of that? But it's a collective agreement from the CEO down to the general managers, down to everybody who is involved within that operation, to discuss, look, see, what does that element mean? And whether that then be, for example, within a business on say a production line, for example, does the person at the start of the production line, is he clear with, has clear clarity on what he or she's working on? Does the next person, then when it comes to manufacturing or the output or the marketing department, for example, are they clear on what that is, what that element is, and are they up and down the levels, top down, and then horizontally across levels, so across those organizations? So in my context, from coach to sports scientist to performance psychologist to medical team, are they clear with, and are they crystal clear with what those things are and what those elements are?
I really love that, because one of the takeaways that I get when we're working with clients is they don't have anything of even a working kind of even a rough version of a shared mental model. And so they often ask for our perspective as to whether this person who's been through a training program is ready for a leadership role, as an example. And we may have seen them, let's say, 5 to maybe 8 times within a 12-week period. Very limited, they're in a classroom environment, and our perception is really about whether how much they engaged with the delivery or the content we were sharing, which is completely different to sitting down with their line manager and going, okay, how's X person working in the business? How are you finding them on a day-to-day basis when you speak to them 4 or 5 times a day and hear a feedback from other people in the business about that individual? And it's, yeah, and they often, our experience is they overemphasize our perspective and sometimes underweight the other, just because we're quote unquote specialists in this area. And I think that's we struggle to do that because we don't know them on a working day basis, or there's a real disparity there. And no doubt that sounds like it plays out in your world too.
Yeah, sure. And I think to probably try and simplify, hopefully, if I understand that correctly, is everybody within the organization needs to know what the end goal is, what the end game is. So we're all working towards something that's got a clear clarity as to what that person's goal is. Now, within academy football, you'll have potential Premier League players, you'll have potential Championship players, League One players, so that everyone's got different goals, and there'll be no different in terms of an organization or a business that has different goals within that. Now, within those different areas, that's like a top-down need. So the needs of the game from our perspective, or the needs of the industry in your environment certainly, is how are we then going to get there? So what part does everybody play within the organization to get us to where we need to get to? So I'm just thinking here in terms of what does the marketing team need to do? What does the production line need to do? What does sales need to do? Those sort of things. So it's all integrated. It's hopefully all coherent with everybody working on the same thing and working towards the same thing would be potentially how I would interpret that within the business world as well.
I think it's that getting clear. A lot of companies often want to jump straight to like implementation of something. Let's just do a tackling drill. Let's just do a tackling drill. Oh, hang on a second. Why don't we just get really clear as to why are we doing tackling right now anyway? I think it's getting that clarity where there's a tendency to just want to take action versus correct diagnosis of quote unquote or selection of priorities. Matt, I'm over. We've gone well over here. Let me just ask two final questions. First of all, who do you look up to given you've looked at all these different academies, who do you think is doing this really well? I'd be very interested. And maybe outside of the expected ones, so outside of category one, who you'd expect them to be doing well, who's doing it well from your perspective? And secondly, why did you move to Swansea Football Club opposed to all the others that maybe you could have? They're a championship team. I just saw they're 15th in the league. Like, why them opposed to anyone else?
I think go straight to the second question first. Is Swansea City has a great history of producing players and the pathway that's available. So I felt it would be the philosophy of the football club in terms of their coaching philosophy, in terms of their playing philosophy, in terms of the players that they produce, are very much aligned with, and very much aligned with my own sort of values and my own working practice as well. And also there was the personal side of it as well. Nice place in the world to live, and live by the sea. Not quite as warm as you, but it was in perspective. There was some certain bonuses there. In terms of football clubs doing it, it's really hard to say that club is doing it really well. Look, we'll all know clubs that are producing players, and they're all producing players. As I mentioned, Swansea City produces a lot of players within a slightly different context from an international perspective as well, but has a clear pathway. But there's lots of clubs doing things very well. Players are being produced and talent is being produced. And as I mentioned earlier, the England youth system would be a great testament to that. And my research has allowed me, and be fortunate enough to, and professional career over the last 18 years or so, has allowed me to work within and us have certainly, but also delve within a lot of the really good practice that a lot of academies at category 1, 2, 3 and downwards are operating with. So it's really given me a good insight into potentially what is important in terms of talent, in terms of talent development.
Awesome. Okay, Matt, I think we're going to round up the conversation there. Thank you so much for staying up late, taking the time to chat to us and overcoming this horrible time difference which happens between Pommyland and Australia. But thank you so much. It's been an invaluable conversation.